magic lies within the trails we ride.
You're listening to the Journey On podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick is a horseman, trainer, international clinician, and author whose mission is to help people achieve a deeper connection with their horses through his transformational training program.
Just because he knows that you know.
G'day everyone and welcome back to the Journey On podcast. I am your host Warwick Schiller and today I have a guest whose journey, you know, looks quite a bit like mine. He's from Australia. He moved to the US, thought that he wanted to have a competitive career in a Western discipline there, and then at some point in time figured out that wasn't exactly one to do. And so this gentleman's name is Will Rogers. He came to America originally to be a cutting horse trainer, and he worked for a guy named Lloyd Cox, who's one of the best cutting horse trainers in the business. Lloyd Cox has won over $7 million in the cutting, but after all, he realized that might not be what his journey was meant to be. And he's good friends with a previous guest of mine on the podcast, Tristan Tucker, and he ended up going to somewhere in Northern Europe, maybe Finland or Sweden, somewhere like that, and trained horses with Tristan for a while. And he now trains dressage horses in Germany. And he has a great story, a great outlook on life, and like I said, a very similar journey to mine. So let's get Will Rogers on the podcast and find out all about him. Will Rogers, welcome to the Journey On podcast.
It's an honor to be here, mate.
Hey, I'm looking forward to this. You know, fellow countryman, somewhat of a, I wouldn't know if it's a similar path, but it's somewhat similar as in the fact we, you know, left our home country, going to follow our dreams, etc. Except I think you may have taken a few more turns in the road than me. You originally were interested in the cutting, weren't you?
Yeah, that's kind of where my original passion, when I started to get more serious into horses, I sort of got fascinated with it and just sort of really went deep on that over my teenage years and early 20s. Yeah.
So did you compete in cutting in Australia?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. I trained a few horses of my own and sort of work with quite a few guys, learning as much as I could from everyone in Australia. Yeah.
Who were your influences there? Because there's a lot of really, like, the cutters there are such good horsemen.
Yeah, well, I started off mainly with Phil Webb.
Oh, really? I've known Phil Webb since I was a kid.
Yeah, he was really good, took me under his wing. And then I spent some time with Aaron Wheatley and a few older guys, not so well-known horsemen and cutting horse trainers and everything like that. So sort of quite a variety of people, yeah.
And then at some point in time you said, I'm going to be serious about this. I'm going to go to the States and like we all do, and work for someone. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I ever since I was pretty young, I always knew that, you know, you have to go to where the best are to sort of learn what it's all about. And my sort of, I was very ambitious and I was kind of thinking, I want to try and get to the top of this whole deal. And I went to a Lloyd Cox clinic in Australia when I was, I don't know, 14 or 15, and I'd seen some training videos of his and everything, and from the minute I saw him work horse, I was like, this guy's just, he's the best, as far as like, I'd never seen anyone that talented, that much timing and feel, and just the style in which he did everything. I just sort of thought, well, that's what I'd like to do. That's the style I'd like to do. So I kind of, my dream was to go to the States, work for him and try and be his apprentice until I was, you know, as good as him, essentially. But when I got there, he already had someone who was his assistant trainer, and he was initially going to leave before I got there, and then he decided to stay on. And so it didn't actually work out there to be the sort of opportunities there for me. I then ventured on to different stables, as far as the people who own Dualray and
the Holmeses.
Yeah, Holmeses. Yep.
Yeah.
I went and worked there in Colorado for a year and a half, and I really loved that. Colorado is such a beautiful place up against the mountains there. Yeah.
And so then what happened? Because, you know, if anybody's seen the pictures of Will these days, he doesn't actually look like a cutter anymore. So what happened there? What happened after that?
Well, I think all along there was sort of a thread of, I just wanted to be exceptionally good with horses, and cutting was my chosen sport at that time. And I wasn't always interested in who won or who was so-called the best on the day or whatever. I was always interested in the artistry, so to speak. You know, who had the most sort of style and finesse and ethic in what they did, and the smartest operator and that sort of thing. And when I was in the States, before I went to the States, I'd met a mutual friend of ours, Tristan Tucker.
Previous podcast guest, yes.
Yes. And we'd got to know each other maybe a year or so before I left to go to the States. And I was training cutting horses down the road from him, and he was starting young horses and dressage horses and fixing race horses and all that sort of thing. And you know what cowboys are like. As starting out as a cowboy, I didn't sort of have a whole lot of respect for a dressage rider. It was just a different code. And a friend of mine was telling me, oh, this Tristan, he's good. You know, he's really something. You should go around there and meet him. And I was like, oh, yeah, we'll see. And sure enough, we met on a fishing trip of a good friend of ours. And Tristan and I sort of instantly sort of hit it off. We're both sort of a bit cut from the same cloth, you know. Extremely,
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah. Extremely addicted to seeking knowledge, finding out the best ways. And he was the first person I'd probably ever met that he was looking for way more than everyone else. He was already partway on that journey, and I was kind of, I'm 10 years younger than Tristan, so started to go around there and hang out with him all the time, and we'd started work horses together a lot, and I just became really fascinated in the way of starting horses and the different things that he was doing at that time. And it was pretty basic compared to what he and I are doing now, but I still could really see that it was the beginning of something much more, kind of thing. And that was kind of exciting. The disappointing thing was he was into dressage and I was into cutting, and at that time it just sort of didn't seem to, our timelines didn't look like they were going to match up in the future. He was going to Europe and I was going to the States, and we sort of thought, well, maybe we'll catch up somewhere, but that might have been it, you know. And after being in the States for a couple of years, we kept in contact, and he kept saying to me, you need to come over here. We could really do something special here in Europe. You know, there's a lot of opportunities and so on. And I think after a couple of years in the States, I got to a little bit of a point where I'd realized that the people who I looked up to the most and in what they were doing, you know, they were 20 years ahead of me, and they looked a little bit tired of it. They didn't look like the passion was there. It was a bit going through the motions. And I'm sure you've probably experienced that in the reining world. It can get a bit repetitive kind of thing.
You know, there's a, I mentioned it before on the podcast, but there's a an Italian that is probably one of the best, well, he is one of the best reiners in the world, lives here in the US, and he has a podcast.
Okay.
And he, last year in his podcast, he had a guest on there who he had worked for when he was younger, who is also one of the best reiners in the world and also one of the best cow horse trainers in the world. And they were talking about the cutting, and both of those guys said, I wish if I could do it all over again, I'd start out with the cutting, because they said, you know, like to do the reining at the highest levels, you've almost got to turn them into robots. And it's completely about, obedience to everything you're asking them to do. And what you're asking them to do makes no sense to the horse, really. There's no reason. Reining and dressage, I think, are similar in that way, to where there's no reason for the horse to do it. There's no reason to stop here or turn here or move there. But they, you know,
there's not an external motivation kind of thing in any form. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just obedience. And, this guy was saying that he'd spent a week or so in Texas with, what's the Kiwi cutter?
Clint Allen. Yeah.
I think. And, he was just fascinated. He goes, you know what? He said, if I didn't have a huge business and kids that are going through college or whatever, I'd quit right now and start the cutting. He said, it's just, those horses are just, you know, they're so bright eyed and they're so real horses, you know, they're not just a shadow of a horse or whatever. And so in the, and I've come to that conclusion, not that I wanted to do the cutting, but, you know, for a while now it's been like, you know what, I'm not really, I used to be passionate about the reining, and now I look at the world a bit differently, and I still think it's cool, and I just have the utmost respect for those guys
100%.
That can get those horses to
100%.
To do that stuff, especially at the level they're doing it these days. Yeah, like in the last 10 years, it's just
phenomenal.
Just jumped up there. And we went to a big show in Arizona recently, and the Derby was on one day, and there was 100 and something runs, and that's going to take 10 or 11 hours. And I sat there in the stands and watched every single run, and it was one of the best ratings I've ever seen, but it's just jaw-dropping as to how far they can
take a horse in such a short time. Yeah.
But you know, there is a lot of repetitiveness to it. And so that's kind of where I'm at with that. Now my wife still is passionate about it, so I'm helping her with her horses and I'm trying to see if we can, you know, she competes in the non-pro, so she doesn't have to push those horses to the very edge of their limit sort of thing. And I'm still trying to figure out if we can, you know, have the relationship and have the connection and still have the reining at the same time. And with, so far it's working, but I think it takes a particular type of horse to do that.
I think that's actually, that's the future in all sports, because I think that, within all sports, there's a lot of good things and there's a lot of not so good things. And I think that the future of equestrian sports or horse training in general, you know, there needs to be, you know, like a lot of the things that you're working on, I'm also very much thinking along the same lines. And I think trying to find how the horse can kind of get a sense of accomplishment from what they're doing, because they've been helped and supported and developed to where they can show what they're capable of. Because I think at the end of the day, all of us, as much as growth is uncomfortable at times, once we have grown and we have developed, you know, no one wants to turn back the clock and say, oh, I wish I was a little more underdeveloped and less capable, you know. And I think that in the horse sport world, if it's done well, you know, these horses really, really expand, you know, their athletic ability, their confidence, their intelligence, their just ability to handle life better, and also that sense of the sort of sense of, you know, when you see a champion horse, you know, it's almost like they know it as much as everyone else. You know, it's like they transcend just a trained horse. It's like they embody it, kind of thing. And that's something that I think everyone really admires, you know.
Yeah, so we're getting a little bit off track
here.
Yeah,
sorry,
that's all right. You were looking at these old cutters. I don't mean old cutters, but
yes.
older guys who were your heroes, and you're looking at them, and you're thinking,
yeah,
I'm not sure if these guys are just enjoying it anymore. They've got to the point in life where this is what I'm doing, and this is how I support myself and my family.
Yeah, and also, I just sort of thought, like, if I'm going to spend 15, 20 years, you know, I want to be feeling good about, you know, allocating that time to it. And maybe there's more to working with horses than just the cutting sport kind of thing. And it, as much as I appreciate cutting, I'm so glad that I've done what I've done, because it's taken me on a whole different adventure that I'm incredibly grateful for. And so what happened is Tristan kept contacting me, and he said, look, come over to Europe. We could do some great things together. And I thought, what the hell? He was living in Denmark. He was training out of a really good friend of ours' place, Morten Thompson, very respected dressage trainer, and a great guy. And so I just thought, all right, I'll do it. We'll just move to Denmark and see how it goes. So I got off the plane, big straw hat with a feather in it, and I didn't own normal clothes almost. So I stuck out, like, you know, you can imagine, as you've probably experienced in some airports, you might have felt a little bit out of place or looked at quite a bit on your travels. But so I started out there with Tristan, and we started to basically just take on any opportunity we could, training any horses, because we sort of wanted to build up our name and reputation of what we could do. So we work with a lot of young horses, difficult horses, dressage horses, jumping horses, and we were in a bit of a phase of developing our horsemanship and our skills and our abilities. And in that time period, we worked with a lot of very difficult horses that had all sorts of things go wrong. And this sort of, because we're working with a lot of sensitive warm bloods and that sort of thing, it sort of shaped our approach to training and how we went about things. And we were just sort of in a very much trying to see how far we could go with what we're doing, and probably a bit like you know, just seeking knowledge, trying everything, learning from everywhere, and trying to put it together and come up with something that, you know, we were hoping for something that was you know, going to give us an edge in the industry and give us a lot of opportunities, kind of thing.
So these difficult horses, I've got my fingers up in inverted commas here. Were they actually difficult horses, or were they horses that had been handled in such a way to create difficult horses?
Well, I would say that nearly all horses, if there's any difficulty, as you would know, it's human interference, isn't it? Mostly. But I think it was a bit of a combination, you know, like you'd have horses with strong instinctive genetics, together with maybe not always very skilled people, and then, you know, you stack quite a few negative experiences together, and then you've sort of got the sort of horses we're working with a lot of the time, you know, traumatized, or horses that a lot of people had tried a lot of things with and failed, and then they're, you know, down to their last chance, or, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think we've both been in that situation.
Mm. And it, I mean, it's something that has turned out to be a great blessing, because when everything you do doesn't work, as you know all too well, then it, you have to dig deeper and you have to find more and you have to discover more. And so I think in that time period, we learned a great deal. You know, those horses kind of exposed us to our limitations and then caused us to expand. And yeah, so it was a good...
That is a great line right there. Those horses exposed us to our limitations. Let me write that one down. That is cool. And so were you guys doing any Liberty stuff at the time?
I had done a little bit when I was in the States, and I didn't know what I was doing. I was just actually using I was using the principles of getting a horse connected to a cow on a horse. And then I just started playing with that. I didn't, you know, it was pretty rough. Like, it wasn't like I knew what I was doing. I was just sort of making it up as I went. But that was in America. But then when I was in Denmark, I had this idea of having a Frisian mare, and then a beautiful Frisian, and training a pure Liberty horse, you know, train as much as I could. And so I got a 2-year-old mare. and from there, I started playing with a lot of Liberty. Same thing, I didn't really know what I was doing. I was sort of making a lot of it up as I went, but that was kind of where that sort of passion started, kind of thing, yeah.
Who was doing the Liberty stuff first, you or Tristan?
Probably me, I think. I mean, Tristan's probably done bits and pieces of it in between, but I think it was maybe a little bit more my sort of passion from the beginning. But I think both of us had appreciation for it, but I think I was sort of maybe a little bit more interested in it in the beginning.
And did you just figure the whole thing out on your own?
No. If I did, then I'd be a genius. In the beginning, I kind of tried a lot of stuff and got, obviously, I probably tried to watch different things and stuff, but that's a little bit later in the story when I came across my mentor.
We'll get to that later then. So you move over to Denmark. You arrive at the airport with your cowboy boots and your cowboy hat with a big old feather sticking out of it. You and Tristan are training some horses, and these horses are exposing you to your limitations. I love that line. Where's the dressage stuff come in?
Well, I mean, Tristan has obviously, you know, a lot of his life been riding dressage, and that's something that working together with him, he really sort of showed me really what was involved with it, and I became more and more fascinated with it as I got to do more of working with it. And I think with the thing that I liked about cutting and the thing that I like about dressage are a little bit similar, even though they're very different sports. That with a good, and I suppose reining, you can do the same, but it, like with a cutting horse, you can have a super talented horse, but you still have to help him with his form and style and the way he goes about things. You can have a big influence on in the cutting. And that's why I love Lloyd Cox so much, because, you know, he gets those horses, they have such a smooth, slick style that
they have a look about them, don't they? And that move that they make, that they're like a border collie working a sheep.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how he works them. You know, he enhances that. And so with dressage, what I liked is I like the fact that exceptional riders can enhance a horse to their potential, or towards their potential. And for me, this has always been the thing, like, I've always wanted to try and reach my potential. I want to help other people reach their potential. I want to go as far as I can go with what I'm doing. And when I saw Totalus live in Aachen, I that was when I was like, oh, okay, this is next level sort of stuff. Because that horse, I mean, obviously now the quality of dressage is getting higher and higher, but at that time, you know, he was so far ahead of everything else. And I remember being in, you know, Aachen's obviously the biggest show in Germany, and seeing every single person, thousands and thousands of people just absolutely mesmerized by one horse.
Was that at the World Equestrian Games?
No, that was before that. It was on the way to that. I think it would have been 2010. And once I saw that, I was like, okay, I'm all in on this now, as far as, you know, this is, as far as riding goes, this is the highest level sort of thing. And that's where I really got hooked. So Tristan's influence and then seeing Totalus, that was kind of, yeah, really got me fascinated in that, yeah.
And so then how did your dressage career go on from there? I mean, did you stay working with Tristan or what?
Well, Tristan and I moved to the Netherlands. So we, at that time, the Dutch dressage scene was at the top of the tree. That, you know, Totalus was winning everything, and they had Parzival, and they had some other really successful horses. And the breeding program, they were breeding a lot of the best horses down there. So we thought, why don't we go down there? You know, we don't need to stay in Denmark. We're not, you know, from Denmark. We can move wherever we want. We can, you know, go where the good horses are and where the opportunities are. And so Tristan had got an opportunity to go down there and train with some good people. And so I said, look, yeah, I'd love to go as well. And so we took our businesses sort of down there, and we sort of continued sort of collaborating and doing our own thing. And that was sort of another chapter of like experiencing these high caliber sensitive horses, and also sort of the whole dressage sport. And around during that time, my wife, who's a international Grand Prix rider from Sweden, she wasn't my wife then, obviously, she came down, and she was coming down to work with Tristan. And then one thing led to another, and then we ended up together. And then she's been a huge mentor of mine in the dressage, you know, like she's really been, I mean, Tristan sort of helped get me started and going. And then sort of Anna has been one of my main mentors and trainers since then, kind of thing. So that's kind of how that went.
So I've got a question about that, because there's an old saying, like, I don't know if it's in the reining industry or whatever, but you can't take lessons from somebody you've seen naked.
Isn't that the truth?
You know, so how, I mean,
you
that
you
is
can't
hard.
Take like, lessons. You can't take lessons well from someone you see naked.
Okay. Yeah, because it's, you get the whole, you know, you're not just, when you're getting help from your spouse, when they tell you something to, you know, they tell you to do something, there's not just the information that they're telling you to do right there. There's every argument you've ever had in your entire life.
Yes, that's
is right. A part of that.
That's
you
right.
know what I mean? So it's
yeah.
it's quite hard to take that. I've been on the other end of the scale trying to help my wife, and so I know from the feedback I get that sometimes there's
yeah look it's 100% it's very difficult. I think everyone, I have not met anyone, I always if someone says they train their wife or husband and it goes really well, then I'm very suspicious what the story is. Because I've met people who have got incredibly good relationships, but when it comes to training, it's always a little bit difficult. But look, to be honest with you, you know, I think like everyone, I've had those challenges, and I've helped my wife a lot. But at the end of the day, it's always a work in progress. We're trying to work towards, you know, being better students and better partners and all that sort of stuff. But she's sort of got so much experience and really helped me so much. And I think I have for her as well with what she's doing. And I think, to have a trainer like that under the same roof, you know, that sort of thing, you can't pass that up.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, especially when it works.
For sure, for sure.
So you guys have moved, you and Tristan moved down to the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
You're doing stuff, and your wife's name's Anna, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So Anna comes in to work with Tristan, you guys end up getting together. Then what happens?
So Tristan bought his own place, and we took over the full stable. And I was sort of a little bit in Tristan's shadow in a lot of ways, understandably so. You know, he's 10 years older than me, and I sort of was also trying to make a name for myself so that I could sort of continue making a living. And I sort of came to the realization that a lot of the sort of training that we're doing was based around, you know, helping people understand their horses better and also preparing their horses for success. A lot of horses, probably all over the world, but particularly in Europe, they're just what I would call very underprepared for everything that happens to them. So they just run into a lot of trouble. And the way I was going about things at that time was very much just trying to help prepare horses for success and build them up so that they could cope with whatever environment they were put in, and that they had enough knowledge and understanding to work through that. And so at that time, when you're doing something different or new or not seen so often, you have a fair bit of resistance. You know, people are sort of saying, oh, this is bullshit, this doesn't work. Well, I don't know, you know, I don't know if this is anything for me. And I was getting a bit tired of that. And so my wife and I started to think about, like, how can we do clinics or performances that can change people's mind, that they can see something and go, okay, this is for real. You know, we can't deny what we're seeing here. And so that was where I started to come up with these sort of, together with my wife, these show ideas where you combine dressage with an extreme environment so that people can see that a horse can work just as beautifully and with you in the most extreme environment as they can, you know, at home, sort of thing. And so that's where these concepts of the show with the tarps and combining the dressage at Liberty. And I don't know if you've seen the video with my wife. We had a freestyle motocross guy doing big air tricks over her while she's doing Grand Prix dressage and fire and all this sort of stuff.
You know what? I have seen that, but I didn't realize that was your wife, because I didn't see it in relation to you. I've just seen it
float around somewhere. Yeah.
Really? So the motorbike doing the backflips and stuff over the top of her while she's doing the Grand Prix dressage and fire and flames and music and...
Yeah, and all the chaos, yeah.
That is cool.
Because the thing that was nice about that show, you know, that was the first sort of big international show we did, and people sort of walked out of there, and you could just see the change in them. They just sort of, you could see them realize, okay, these guys are for real. You know, there are a lot of charlatans out there, but whatever they're doing is working. So, and that's where I started to realize this was a way to demonstrate, instead of talking about it and telling everyone and preaching to everyone, showing it and then saying, okay, now let's talk about it. You know what I mean? So you sort of walk your talk a bit, you know?
So that a show like that, was that something you organized, or was it part of another? Was it part of a
horse? It was part of an international competition. And they'd sort of, we'd done something and it had got a lot of exposure, and then that we got invited to do these things, yeah.
Was it like at night time or something like that, was it?
Yeah.
So you guys, the entertainment?
Yes, basically, yeah. So we were trying to combine sort of, yeah, basically entertainment, but intertwining the education sort of thing.
You know what I think is so cool about that is a lot of times at, well, I don't know a lot of times, but what I've seen, because I've got friends who do Liberty stuff, and, you know, they do a lot of horse entertainment. They will have them do stuff at a dressage show as the entertainment. And I've been there for some of them, and you can see some people are like, yeah, that's pretty cool. And you can see the others are like, yes, but that's not dressage. I mean, that horse is not biomechanically correct. And so they can kind of have a bit of a negative spin on it, or that's not necessarily applicable to us,
exactly.
Whatever.
100%.
But I think it's brilliant, the idea of having, you know, Grand Prix dressage in the entertainment, to where they go, holy cow, you can do that and that at the same time. I think that's brilliant, especially a brilliant way to. And it's not about sticking it to them. It's about opening, you know, it's about planting a seed, and you've got to be able to plant the right seed for it to grow.
For sure. And I think that was exactly the idea, because as much as, you know, performing with the horse in a difficult, like any sort of big environment, whether it's a big competition or show or whatever, it's always challenging, but a lot of people, what I was finding were letting the horse be the scapegoat. It's like, oh, yeah, he was tense today and he was this or that, or he was having a bad day, you know.
It's very easy to say that, isn't
it? It is.
Say my skateboard was a bad boy today.
Exactly.
Or my BMX bike was a bad boy today, but it's easy
exactly.
to go.
But look, I mean, horse. There is, you know, of course there's challenges, but if your horse is tense in the warm-up or at home, of course it's going to go over the edge at the show. But I think there's the thing that it's funny with that, because it continued on to sort of the direction I'm going now a little bit with the performances and everything. I started to realize that the horse needs to be the star always. It's not about me or you or whoever. It's always the horse has to shine. And to me, a horse shines best when you see them doing the work and feeling comfortable enough to do the work, because you've helped them, you've prepared them, you've got that level of trust and connection, and you've been for them in those moments where they need it, in the lead up, so that in the show you've covered all your bases, and then the horse can shine. And that's always my aim, you know. I always want people to walk out of there and feel like, yes, they might say this is nice or that, but that I want the horse to be the one that gets them, you know, in the end, you know.
And how many of those types of shows have you done? Like, is it a big part of what you do?
I've done quite a few. I've sort of, quite a few international shows, but I haven't sort of gone on the road and just, I've done it with actually quite a few different horses, you know. And sometimes I've only done, set a horse up for one show and didn't do another one with them. So I've also enjoyed that process, but I'm sort of not someone who, not that I think it's wrong or anything, but I don't know, I'm a bit special in that way. I don't believe in the doing a show all the time. I don't want my horses to lose that sparkle. I don't want them to look like they've been used and abused too much, done too many things, been too many places. I want them to still stay fresh. It's at heart, I'm a bit of an artist in a way, because for me, it's not it's the performance itself. If the horse doesn't shine, then I don't want to be there. I'm not going there for the money. I'm not going there for the accolades. It has to be that the horse kind of, yeah. And I'm always disappointed if I've messed up with a preparation or missed something and it hasn't quite gone to plan. And I'm getting better with that these days, but that's really the thing that's important to me with it, you know.
And so would you say most of what you do, you know, you do those shows at times, but mm-hmm. most of what you do these days is training dressage horses?
It's a combination of training dressage horses and Liberty horses. So I've got this team of Liberty horses that I'm building. This has sort of been a long-term dream for many years. So I've got 10... I've got 9 grey modern sport horse types, like warm bloods, and one, he's a warm blood cross knap stripper spotted sport horse. And
if anybody doesn't know what a knap stripper is, it looks like a Appaloosa warm blood.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
It is an actual breed, though, isn't it?
Yeah. It's a Danish breed, yeah. With this, so this is my big life. It's been a big life dream of mine to be able to know what it feels like to be someone who can have a huge herd of horses working with you, and going into that exploratory space of seeing what's possible, kind of thing, and then sort of trying to inspire people through creating beautiful moments that people can kind of fully appreciate the horse and fully appreciate what can be possible with them, kind of thing. That's a little bit my idea with this kind of thing.
Now, you've got the team of grey horses. Did you tell me that you're trying to develop another team as well?
Yeah, well they're grey as well.
Really?
Yeah. No, because the thing is, the reason why I got the grey horses is because I was thinking about black horses or something like that. But the thing is with white horses, in the shows and all that sort of thing, like they catch the light. You can see in a dark, you know, in a nighttime show, when the lights are on, you can see all their expressions, all the nuances, all the details, whereas sometimes a darker coloured horse, it looks like a silhouette. And when you have a herd of horses, I think it's easy for them to all just kind of look a little bit like silhouettes, kind of thing. And I want all my horses, obviously I'm biased, but they've all got their own personality and uniqueness. And I think that's what also adds to it a lot. So that's a bit the idea with the grey anyway. Yeah,
they certainly look good in the pictures I've seen. There's an amazing picture of you in front of, so you've got, I don't know how many's in that picture. They're all grey horses.
Six,
and you're standing.
Six in that one, yeah.
And you're standing on the two in the middle's backs in front of the, what is that, the French Alps behind you?
No, Swiss Alps, yeah.
The Swiss Alps.
Jungfrau, the top of Europe, as they call it.
Really, it's an amazing picture. But those, I just love the expression on those horses, and they're all at Liberty. Mm. And what is that? Is that in the middle of a field or something?
Well, it's actually on top of a mountain, believe it or not. So if you in that, I've got this photo over here on the wall. It drops down, and in the valley they have two of the most beautiful lakes in the world. And then on the other side of that valley, they've got the biggest mountain range in that area. All the big snow-capped peaks, and I was trying to find for that film for the Aspire Foundation. I was trying to find the most beautiful locations I could possibly find to do this with. And when we were down there, this one of these Swiss guys who had a hotel, he said, "You know what? I've got the perfect location. People fly from all over the world to film here for commercials and all that sort of stuff. It's really special." And I didn't even know it existed. And getting the horses up there was not so easy. I mean, it was pretty damn steep, but it's a stunning location. Like, yeah, incredible.
So how did you get the horses up there?
Well, we had small two-horse trucks. But I mean, I'm a boy from the plains in Australia, you know, so driving horses up mountains is not something that I'm, you know, all that comfortable with. But thankfully, you know, the guy who was with us, he knew where we were going, and we're driving, crawling up there, and the horses sort of, for the most part, traveled pretty well, but it's always a little bit sketchy taking horses where you don't know exactly where you're going and pretty steep and everything. But it's a beautiful place, beautiful place.
And so that was for some filming for the Aspire Foundation?
Yeah. So
do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So the Aspire Foundation is a foundation that I started up last year, at the end of last year. And this is a little bit my future sort of direction, a big part of my future direction. And a good friend of mine, a mentor of mine out of the horse world, sort of really suggested that, you know, this is starting a foundation for horses could be something where I can really share my knowledge and experience and help a lot of people and horses in the world, and combine that together with my performances and shows. And and then essentially what I've always thought is the biggest thing in the horse world is, at least from my opinion, and I'm sure you probably agree with this, is that the horse's well-being ultimately comes down to us. You know, as much as you can give them good food and accommodation and all that sort of thing, like, really for us, if we come to the horse from a good place, then that's where it all starts and ends, I think. And so with this foundation, I sort of want to, I mean, I'm very inspired by you, what you're doing, because I think you're having a huge impact on so many people and sharing so much incredible wisdom and practical stuff. And I think this is also what I want to do with the foundation, as well as help horses who are in difficult situations as well. But I really feel that if we get more knowledge out there and it becomes more normal to be aware of, you know, how to understand horses better and go about taking care and training them better, I think this is just going to hopefully spread further, you know.
So the film that you were doing, is that like a, can it be a film, or was it like some sort of an ad for the Aspire?
Yeah, it was a promotion, like, because I was going to do a live performances to present this foundation publicly, but then of course COVID hit and you know, that wasn't going to be the case. So then I sort of thought, what about doing a film to capture the essence of what this foundation will be about, and a little bit introducing me to people as the founder and sort of spokesperson for the foundation, so that people can kind of feel, okay, this guy's a real horseman. So he's not just some person with good ideas and, you know, good intentions. He's also got some experience and you know, he's got something to bring to the party, you know. So that was a bit the idea. And Switzerland's, you know, to me, the most beautiful nature in the world. And to take my horses down there, I've always had that sort of, I think, beautiful horses in beautiful nature with a beautiful connection, it sort of trumps everything, I feel, you know.
Yeah, well, that picture, you can tell you're out there in the middle of the nowhere on these six horse. You got these six horses who are completely at liberty. You stand on the back of two of them, and the Swiss Alps are in the background. It's I mean, all those pictures from that series are just unbelievable.
Yeah, no, it was a magic trip. Absolutely.
So you've been on a bit of a, I don't know, somewhat similar journey to me, and I don't mean related to horses. I mean related
to
yourself, and I think that foundation's probably a part of that. But do you want to talk a little bit about some of that?
Absolutely. Well, I was thinking today, we should just dive straight into this. We can skip all the past history because it's only sort of a timeline, you know. I feel like I'm just reaching where it's all at now, kind of thing. And so I can share with you, because I've been, you know, just from a distance inspired by your transformation and the path that you've taken, because to me I completely admire people who can really change in terms of, you know, can really open up and change. And I think along the way, and this is something that I've experienced in my journey with horses, like I think when I was starting out, I was just so determined to succeed. It was just to be successful was you know what it's all about. And as I've gone along, I've always thought, you know, I need to be able to get as good as I can, learn as much as I can, keep proving myself over and over and over and over and over again, and to get better opportunities to move up in what we're doing. And the funny thing is, I've reached a point where I've done a lot of things, and I've a lot of things that I would have dreamt I would have never even accomplished, sort of thing. And I come to the point the start of this year, and I was absolutely miserable, completely miserable, and got into a real deep depression, and I was just spiraling, and not just like it was a big combination of things, you know, financial pressures and a lot of commitments and you know, all sorts of things, staff troubles and all sorts of things. But it was almost like the universe was taking me to the place I needed to go. I needed to get low enough and suffer enough to be ready. And I sort of hit a point where I was just like, I got to do something. I got to do something extreme. I got to work on myself big time. I've got to change something, because I just can't keep on this this path, you know. And I think what I looking back at it, what I realized I've done over the time is I've just held on to all these things throughout my life, all the hardships, all the struggles, all the things that got me to this point. I started to carry them all with me. So I was getting to the point where I was going into any situation and I was just carrying all the past with me. I was carrying all the struggles, and it just became unbearable, you know, just simply working with a horse or turning up and doing what I needed to do just felt like I, you know, just didn't have the energy for it almost. I was just struggling that much. And just when things got to about rock bottom, I came across a video and it said something like, I think the title was something like freeing yourself from negative thoughts and feelings and letting go, or something like that. And I sort of thought, oh, well, that sounds a bit relevant to where I'm at the moment. And it was an interview with Michael Singer, who's an author of The Untethered Soul. And I would highly recommend anyone who's particularly in a dark place if you're in a dark enough place, you need to pick this book up, because I don't think it's necessarily a book that anyone would pick up and really run with it, because I think that real transformation, it's sort of like you got to get to a dark enough place to be willing to...
To want to transform.
Yeah, want to transform, you know. And
that's my wife's favorite book, like as far as any of that sort of thing. She goes, yeah, that's the one, when I read that one, that made more sense.
Exactly. So
else.
So basically, you know, just for everyone listening, this book is... I've always had a little bit, like I've grown up as a Christian in a sort of Christian family, but, and I've always believed in God to some extent, but as I wouldn't say that my faith has been strong at times and other times not really at all, I'd have to be honest. And when I came across this book and I started to listen to interviews from him and everything, I was just like, oh my goodness. This guy's not selling some, you know, approach to, you know, he's not selling anything, an agenda or anything like that. He's revealing the truth of existence to you, and the sort of secrets to living life almost. And I started to look into it more, and I was like, okay, this is where I need to go, because I think the thing with, you know, a lot of spiritual teachings, I've always been a bit, that's not really my thing, because it's a bit too weird or strange, or they use confusing language and you end up feeling more lost than, you know, found, kind of thing. And with this book, it was just like his eloquence in simplifying the most complicated things and just helping you understand what life's all about. It just it opened the door to me. And so I went to the Swiss Alps by myself. My wife was thankfully very accommodating to allow me to go. We've got a 14-month-old son, and she said, look, you know, you need to do this, you need to go. And so I went down there by myself with this book, and I went down there for 3 weeks, and I hiked each day, and I was reading through this book, and it's the turning point in my life. Like I feel that there's sort of before this, you know, awakening, so to speak, and then after, and I realized that that's why I almost think that the past got me to here, and that's all it did. You know what I mean? Like it's sort of almost like I can appreciate the things from the past, but it's almost like not really that relevant anymore. You know what I mean? Like
I know exactly what you mean.
and I think, and for everyone listening out there, I've sort of, you know, I mean, I haven't been training horses as long as you have, mate, but I've been pushing hard my whole life. I've just been had the throttle down, going, you know, trying as hard as I can, but I've also struggled a lot along the way. And I've just kind of thought that's normal, and you just got to soldier on and just get on with it. But the biggest thing that I've realized is that no destination or no achievement or no when you get this or when you get there or when you make enough money, none of that's that important if you can't live the journey right. And it's obviously such a cliche thing, but when I realized through this book that the thoughts that I was having in my head was not who I was, that I am the observer of my thoughts. I'm the sort of soul inside that watches my brain activity or puts, you know, activates my, engages with my brain. Once I realized that that was going on and that I could let go of a lot of these thoughts, that was so huge to me, because it had been so many years before since I would say that I could work a day with my horses or with people with the absence of judgmental thoughts or negative thoughts or resisting what is taking place in life, you know. That was just, such an incredible freeing experience. And of course I'm daily trying to work on it now, but what's been your experience with that, Warwick, as far as was there any particularly pivotal moment that where you sort of did, was there a certain rock bottom you had to hit?
You know, good question. I think I'd been at rock bottom for quite a long time on the inside. On the outside, everybody thought I was happy-go-lucky and all that sort of stuff, but just had a whole lot of self-loathing, I'd say, like putting shit on yourself all the time. And, and it's funny, you have those, you know, you're having those struggles, but you don't, I don't think, I wasn't aware I was having them, even though I was aware I was having them. I don't know how to put that, but.
Well, it's so familiar, it's hard to imagine what it would be like another way.
To live a different way, yeah. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Brené Brown. And, you know, she talks a lot about vulnerability. And I did I was at a horse expo in Madison, Wisconsin a few years ago. And at those horse expos, sometimes we will do a session with a horse, but sometimes they'll have you do a talk session where you're in like a lecture hall sort of thing. And there's one I use a lot when I have to do that, and I just call it Everything I Learned in Life That I Learned from Horses. And it's basically life experiences I've learned from horses that apply to other parts of life, you know. And I might do it once every 6 months or so, depending on the horse expos. But every time I do it, it's a little bit different. And this one I did at this horse expo, there's a couple of hundred people in the room, and I admitted stuff to these 200 people that I probably hadn't ever admitted to anybody before, possibly even myself.
And what caused that? Just because?
It had been brewing, I guess. But when I was done, I walked back to my booth, and Barbara Schulte, you know who Barbara Schulte is?
Yes.
Yeah. She's been a previous guest on the podcast. I walked back to my booth and I went past her booth, and I'd only just met her that morning. And she said, "Oh, how did it go?" I said, "Oh, I am exhausted. I feel like I've been run over by a train." And she goes, "Why?" And so I said, "You know, I kind of spat out some stuff that I don't think I've ever spat out before. And I spat it out to a couple of hundred strangers." And she said, "Yeah, well, Brené Brown says vulnerability is the ultimate badassery," or whatever, you know. And it was about, and that weekend there were so many synchronistic things happened. It wasn't funny after that, like these weird, just crazy weird synchronistic. And then about a week after that, I was having a conversation one night. It was the Saturday night of a clinic. I'd done a clinic all day, and I was at a friend's house that night, and there was a group of us sitting around talking, and it was almost like they'd planned it, but one of them asked a question that triggered me a bit, and another one asked a question that triggered me a bit more, and the third one asked me a question that triggered me a bit more, and all of a sudden the room just shifted like 45 degrees. It was like I got dizzy, and then I just started bawling my eyes out, and I'm like, "Who the hell are you people, and what planet are you from?" It's like, I don't know.
So you sort of had a release kind of thing, like.
Brené Brown talks about when she had her nervous breakdown and her therapist calls it a spiritual awakening. Well, it was one of those things, whatever it was, But I think it had been brewing for a long time, but that that vulnerability, that being able to share stuff does something to you, but also I think getting stuff off your chest does something to you too. So I think, and it's not just the vulnerability to others, I think, for me, it might have been the vulnerability to me.
Yeah, the transparency kind of thing.
Like I actually admitted, not only did I admit to myself that that was what was going on, I admitted to other people. So I think that might have been the start of it. But I mean, looking back, the start of it was way before that. But nothing had really happened up to that point in time. It's kind of like training a horse when you're just doing the basics and doing the basics and doing the basics, and then one day, bam, they all gel together enough to where something cool happens, and you didn't actually train the cool thing. It's just it
fell into place.
Falls into place because you stuck to the basics so much. And I think I just had things going on for quite a long time. But so your trip to the Swiss Alps, was that was pretty recent, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was not long ago at all. I think I left in the middle of April, come back the middle of May. The interesting thing, I was having a bit of a sort of realization today, because I was thinking a bit about you, because we're doing this podcast, and I was thinking about how you were saying on one of your podcasts that, you know, you've spent 48 years of your life one way, and then however many years after that, a somewhat of a changed man or a transformation, and how the blessing of that is, you know, you've got a great recollection of what it was like before and how it is now and the difference, and so you can kind of, you can talk to people on both sides of the fence, so to speak. And also what I was realizing, and some of the stuff I've been learning and working with recently, I just realized that it talks about in this book that the greatest obstacles and challenges in your life are where you have the most spiritual growth, kind of thing. Now, for everyone who is a bit uncomfortable with the word spiritual, I've also had a little bit an uncomfortable relationship with that initially, but what... I don't know if you agree with this work, but what spiritual sort of means to me is just your internal life, how you feel the inside, and how that affects everything on the outside, rather than how the outside affects you on the inside, kind of thing. And so I just sort of see it as just your inner journey, how you feel on the inside, what people don't always see. And I was just thinking about how... I was thinking that I wrote it down here. It seems to be that in our life that the biggest sort of mission that we have or whatever is to transcend our personal struggles and traumas or challenges that we've held on to in our life, and sort of get to the other side of that and share that with other people. Because, you know, like you've sort of talked about, you've been shut down for many years, and for me, I've had a number of struggles of just sort of resisting things and resenting things, or feeling I'm not good enough, or just different things that I've carried with me and held on to, and getting to the other side of those things. And I'm not saying I'm perfect or anything like that, but feeling what it's like to be on the other side of that is, to me, the biggest thing. Because, like, as a horse trainer, I don't care how good a horse trainer you are, if you're not right on the inside, you're nothing of what you could be, kind of thing. And also, your life is nothing compared to what it could be. And I've just sort of, and that sort of really inspired me to try and incorporate this into the way I approach everything, and as far as like also helping people. Because I just sort of realize if you're not right on the inside, you're just going to essentially taint or project that onto everything you do, and it's, you can actually do something about it, and it's not as hard as you might think. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's funny, while you were talking then, I'd just been scrolling through the notes in my phone, because I knew I'd written down Brené Brown's definition of spirituality.
Okay, yeah, hit me.
But and what it says actually, she's got a definition of authenticity and of spirituality. But her definition of authenticity is the daily practice of letting go who we think we are supposed to be and embracing who we actually are.
Yeah.
Choosing authenticity means cultivating the courage to be imperfect, to set boundaries, and to allow ourselves to be vulnerable. She said, spirituality is a deep held belief that we are inextricably connected to each other by something bigger than us. Doesn't say what that thing is, but we are all inextricably connected to each other by something bigger than us. I should go back and read the notes in my phone. I'll have an idea or I'll hear something. I'll write it down the notes in my phone and then I forget I ever wrote it down. And I was just scrolling through there looking for that. And I'm thinking, oh, there's some gold in here. I need to relook at.
For sure. Well, I think one of the biggest things for me with this sort of on a daily level, what I've come to realize, and I know you've talked about this with some of the things you've been doing, but I've always been sort of going out with what I'm doing, having an outcome in mind and really pushing for that outcome. And of course, when you have an outcome that you want, you're attached to it, and it can cause you to feel pressure to reach that outcome. And, you know, if things aren't lining up with that outcome, you know, you can make bad decisions or errors in judgment because you're attached to, oh, I have to get it like this or it has to be like that. And the biggest thing that I've been working on with my horse training is just accepting what is and working with wherever the horse is that day from the very beginning, and from moment to moment moving in the direction I want and staying there with it and not resisting what is. You know, like I think one of the biggest things I've learned with Liberty horses is that when you have a big number of horses, it's very often that you've got, you know, if you've got six minds you're thinking about, that means six different things are happening at one time. So, you know, there's chances are something's not going right somewhere. And if you're attached to it going right, it can bother you. And if a lot of little things bother you, it makes it hard to be able to stay present in the moment and kind of right there with it kind of thing. And by accepting what is completely and not trying to worrying about how it should be or how it was yesterday or how I want it to be, it's just freed me to be in the moment and just know, okay, from here, I'm just going to work with what is. And I mean, it's probably a simple thing. You've probably been working with this for quite a while now, but for me, that's something that it's so powerful because, you know, in the moment, if you're doing the best you can in the moment because you're completely there and without judgment, then the next moment's going to be better and the next moment's going to be better because you're handling each moment just right kind of thing, you know?
But it's, you know, it's just such a balance. You know, I remember I was watching American Idol a couple of years ago and they got down to the final 12 or something or other and they had this like concert thing where they each sing a song and then the next day they have to come up on stage in front of the judges and the judges tell them whether they stay in or go in, whether they're in the final six or whatever it is. And one of the judges is Lionel Richie. And there was this kid who didn't have a lot of confidence in himself, but he had a great deal of talent. He was bloody awesome. And I forget the exact line that Lionel Richie said to him, but he said something like, being successful is having absolute belief in yourself and whatever the complete opposite of that is, you know, like having no faith in yourself at all and absolutely having complete belief in yourself and trying to stay somewhere in the middle.
I mean, it's funny you bring up the balance thing because that's so much of my time is consumed with that. Like, it seems to me like, with everything, especially with the horses, it's like finding that balance point and keeping it within their minds, within their bodies, within whatever you're doing, is just the art. It's just the masterful art, isn't it? And it's obviously the way of life as well. But I love what you've. I was watching some of your principles of training videos leading up to this, and they're fabulous, by the way. I recommend every single person who wants to work with horses needs to watch those videos, because I think you've condensed, some of the best information for people there. You know, because those principles are. It's almost like they're too good to put out for free. Do you get what I mean? Like, in terms of the value of those, if you apply them correctly, if you don't know some of them, it transcends. You know, you could have 1,000 lessons and not pick up some of those principles. You know,
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go on, mate. You go.
I was going to say the funny thing about when I filmed the first season of that was I had a hard time filming it because I had come to realize that I'd taught all my horses to be quite obedient, and they were, most people would think they were great horses, but they didn't have that much expression on their face. And that's what I had to work with. But I was aware how bad they were, even though most people would look and think, hey, they look great. I was aware what was missing. And then I've got to make this bloody TV show thing talking about the principles of training. And I almost don't want to do the things with them I did with them before to get them to that weight. I was having a bit of an existential crisis filming it. As the seasons went on and I'd start to change some things, it was a bit easier. But that, because I've done 3 seasons, but the first season, I look back on it and I go, oh, that's complete shit. And I would really like to start all over again and do them all again.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I'm sort of getting to the point where I sort of feel I'm maybe ready to sort of put content out there for people. I've sort of been resisting it for a long time to put anything public out, and I admire what you've done, and I admire the fact that, you know, you've shared so much stuff for so many years, and it's not easy when you put things out there, because every man and their dog can see everything and judge it and talk about it and, oh, well, that's no good. And, you know, and also, like you say, even when you're doing something like that, you're filming those videos, to you know how exactly you'd like it to be, or after the fact you wish you had done it this way. But to be fair to you, you know, like the message is clear in those films and those videos. And it's funny, because I've been thinking about it a lot with, like, the principles, the techniques, the process you use, how you are, how you feel as a person, how you are on the inside. All those things woven together, trying to find the balance in all those things is really the path to mastery. And you kind of need all those pieces, and each one of those areas is such a deep pool. If you dive deep, you can get lost in technique, you can get lost in process, you can get lost in your personal journey or the principles. But it's just nice that you've got that out there for people, because I think you're very good at, researching and studying high quality, proven, tested principles or knowledge, and formulating it in a way that people can take it in, you know. And I think that's, I respect what you've done there, because not everyone's going to read everything or watch everything, but if they pick up a few of those principles at the least, it's going to help a lot of horses to start with, you know.
Thank you. I everything's a bit of a blessing and a curse, and I've always been you know, I'm very analytical. I've always been stuck in my head. I don't feel, I think. And I think that having my brain work that way, I think I'm good at picking up patterns. And that's where I figured out these 12 principles, because I'm grouping, okay, that's like that, but different, but it's the same. And that's kind of how I come up with them. And so that is a blessing, but it's also a curse too, because I'm too much in my head and not enough in my heart, really. And so, yeah, it's all about
balance. I think I've been a little bit, the same too. I think in a lot of ways there are some pretty big similarities between us, because I've been a collector of knowledge my whole life, a seeker. You know, like if I compare myself to Tristan, he's someone who's a creative genius in his own kind of way. And I just realized pretty early on, I'm not him. You know, I just, like, if you leave him out in the dusty arena by himself, he'll come up with all sorts of stuff. If you leave me out there without some inspiration or some things I can put together, I'm not in the same league, you know. But I've always been obsessed with finding the best knowledge, where, you know, seeking out the best principles, techniques, approach, all that sort of thing. And actually, that's something I wanted to talk to you about, like, as well with my Liberty training. I have a mentor from Australia. His name's Sam Watson, and he's from WA, and he's been my Liberty mentor, essentially. And he and his family they were the ones that have sort of helped me the most with understanding process, principles, like the depth of things. And like Tristan helped me a great deal with my horsemanship, but I think when I went to learn from these guys, they helped deepen my awareness and process and knowledge. And without them, you know, a lot of the stuff I'm doing with my Liberty horses, it'd be zero chance me getting to the level that I want to get to without that. You know, it's years and years and years of carefully well thought out process and experience and trial and error that they've sort of shared with me. So I'm eternally grateful to them for the impact they've had on me too, you know.
You know, it's we're talking about the years and years and years of stuff. And, you know, the thing is, for me, people like, say, like Buck Brannaman or Martin Black, those guys have started thousands and thousands and thousands of horses. And I haven't. But the thing is that once I figured out the principles, I'm not saying I have all the answers, but once I figured out the principles, I could come across a problem that I'd never encountered before. And I go, okay. And I could just break it down. So that's the, you know, that's that, sort of thinking, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But I think, you know, it's funny with that, because everyone has their strengths and weaknesses, and I have a friend of mine. Her name's Yvette Blocker. She has a company called Featherlight Horsemanship, and she's someone who's got incredible feel, a natural feel, you know, you're envious of it because it seems so effortless. You know, she just follows that feel the whole way through, you know. And there aren't many people I've ever met that are quite like that, to that level, you know. But the thing is, you know, you can have all the feel in the world, but you also need process and understanding and to be able to break things down. And of course, that's always the challenge. You know, wherever you're really strong, you're going to generally be weak just as equally somewhere else. And I think the beautiful thing about this whole journey of life is that it doesn't matter where we start out or where we came from or what the story is, we have, if we're willing to keep developing, we can kind of balance things out. And that's the most exciting thing for me now, because I just sort of realized, like, what's possible, you know, if if I'm someone who is good on the inside and can bring that to every situation, and also, you know, understands the principles, the process, the technique, and willing to spend the time with the horses and so on, like, what sort of level can you reach with all those sort of things? But like you say, it's a balance. Like, you can't just be really strong in one area and think that you're going to get all the way. You've sort of got to cover all your bases, and that takes a hell of a lot of dedication and commitment, doesn't it?
Takes a number of lifetimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, 100%. 100%.
It's funny you mentioned Sam Watson before. I've never heard of Sam Watson, and I'm going to present at a horse expo this weekend, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they always read out a bit of a blurb when you come out in the arena or whatever, and they, a lot of times, you know, recently they'll kind of go, oh, one of the world's finest horsemen, Warwick Schiller. I'm like, oh, bloody hell, you've never heard of the world's best horseman. You know, they're somewhere in WA or whatever, and I'm so glad that your mentor have not heard of him, because you know what, you know, I'm quite out there in the public space these days, only because I'm good at explaining stuff.
Well, you know what I mean? I think you know, there's a bit more going on than that, mate. But if you want to narrow it down to that, you can.
Well, I've got friends who are like the lady you were talking about, who are really talented, but they're really hard to teach you because they don't know what they do. There's just so much feel involved.
Exactly. The thing about that, sorry to interrupt you. The thing about that, and this is just something for people to think about is, like, when you watch someone and you're working with horses and you sort of think, oh my goodness, I'd love to be like that. That's what I want. I think the thing that I wish someone told me this earlier on is that someone who has that, what we're talking about, that feel or whatever, that's who they are being. That's the biggest part of it. It's not their technique. It's not this. It's not that. It's who they are inside that allows that. And I see that with you. And I'll be honest with you. If you look at your stuff from earlier on to now, you know, I see a totally different person, but I also see a totally different feeling with your horses. So you can see that with you and your horses. The feeling there is more and more and more and more. And it's who you are. It's who you're being, kind of thing. And that's the same thing for me. What I realize is, like, you know, it's who I am inside that is where the feeling comes from. And like you say, I've always been in my head a lot as well. But I think all of us inside have got a bit of that magic. It's just we're getting blocked by our thoughts and our brains a bit, you know.
That's something I'm trying to work on. But it's all a bloody great balancing act. You know, it's interesting. I've tried to, you know, you and I have been chatting every once in a while for a year or so now. And you know, I think from our first conversation, we got pretty deep right off the bat, you know.
Yeah.
You kind of cut through the shit and said, okay,
that's right. No,
let me ask you
about
this question.
That's right.
But I think there's a reason why you haven't been on the podcast before. We haven't been able to line up before is because I think the universe is waiting for you to go to the Swiss Alps.
That's right. 100%. It should be, I have to tell people, Warwick, contacted me. When was it? We've talked about it a bit, like earlier on in the year or something. And you said, oh, would you like to be on the podcast sometime? I said, yeah, absolutely. Love to. And then of course, I was on my way to rock bottom, quietly behind the scenes. And then when I just come back, I've been a week back from the Swiss Alps, and I was thinking, I just sort of incorporating this stuff into my daily life and working with the horses and so on. And I was thinking, gee, you know, it'd be a good time to do that podcast now while this is sort of, you know, just after the transformation or whatever. And sure enough, I think that day or whatever, I get a message from him. He's like, so when are we going to do this podcast or something? And so, yeah, it's a funny one, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a funny one. And, you know, I was just going to say that you've probably encountered this helping people with horses, but they, some people don't want to do the work, but you find someone who does want to do the work, and then they do the work for a while and makes the horse so much better. And then they kind of rest on their laurels and they just go along and the horse starts to get worse. And a lot of people, when they do that and you point it out, they're like, oh, stupid me. And it is the human condition, because I'm exactly the same way. I wouldn't say I've hit rock bottom recently, but recently I haven't been in the place I had been. But the reason being is because I stopped doing the work. I stopped meditating. I'm like, hey, I feel good. I don't need to do that anymore. I'm busy. I've got stuff to do. Now I'll do it tomorrow. And tomorrow's been going on for about a year now. And just recently I've just started back, and it's bloody hell, it's not like riding a bike. I'm back to the very struggling beginning part. But I understand that, so I don't have any negative. I have the observation of them struggling. I don't have the negativity of them. Oh, bloody hell, you're struggling. I'm like,
yes.
Oh, here we go again. This takes time, and then it'll, you know, it's just a bit of a practice.
It's funny you say that, because this last week I had a couple of days where I was starting to get triggered by things and starting to feel some of the old thoughts and feelings coming up a bit. And it's obviously, you know what it's like when you're in a good place and that starts coming up, you're like, oh shit, I don't want this. How do we let it go, get rid of it? I want to get back to where I was at. And one of the things that, sort of came to my mind was that actually in a way we the biggest trap is that we always think that something else is more important than how we feel on the inside, and it's sort of like, oh yeah, but you know, I've got all these things to do, I can't be not now or whatever. And what I've sort of done a little bit myself, and I'll share it with you a bit, like in the morning, it's a pretty basic setup, but I'll just sort of meditate, and I'll just sort of, and this is something I'd actually like to share with people as well. And I don't know if you've talked about this, but meditation's also a thing that can, you know, if you're not that familiar with meditation, it can also seem a bit like some thing that certain people do, and it's there's all different confusing ways. But in this book, The Untethered Soul, it just basically talks about that meditation is just letting go of your thoughts. That's all it is. It doesn't matter how you do it. If you let go of your thoughts, then that's what it's about. And when you let go of your thoughts, if you think of all those thoughts as things that are disturbing you or stressing you or frustrating you, whatever it might be, in the absence of those, you can feel clear. And when there's no negative things or traffic going on, you can feel clear, and then you can start to feel good, can't you? And from there, you're in the moment without all the judgment and struggles and everything. And what I've been doing is through this book is it's sort of like letting go of all my thoughts and just getting in that meditative state and that good place. And then for me, I don't know what you found, probably it's a bit similar, but because I've been probably had a fairly negative self-dialogue going on inside and stuff, I've also just been trying to think of all the things I'm grateful for towards the end of my meditation, just to try and bring me out of that sort of, what would you call that? That sort of, it's a little bit, we've talked about this before, that sometimes the little bit negative Australian cultural upbringing might be a bit part of it. That sort of,
very much so.
Yeah. but so
you're doing your own tall poppy syndrome.
Exactly. You're bringing everything down around you, kind of thing. But then also, like, you know, getting to that place where I'm grateful for all the things that are in my life, which is then take me to that place where I start to feel better. But then what I've been doing is just thinking about death in that respect of thinking about, if I'm going to die at the end of this week, how am I going to live each day leading up to the weekend or whatever? And one thing that, just for everyone listening, that in this book it talks about at the end, it talks about death and the importance of it, and that, like, if we didn't have death, life would go on forever and everything would be meaningless. And so death shines the light on life rather than sort of the shadow over life, kind of thing. It sort of reflects back at us, you know, like, you got to appreciate this. It's not forever. You know, you got to make the most of it. The only thing is that we act like we got forever. And when death is sort of shines a light on your life, you start to realize, okay, I got to drop all the things that are stressing me or unimportant, or, you know, and that just sort of helps me try and get me into a place where when I go out into the day, the people in my life or the things in my life, I can, I'm not saying I'm good at it or perfect, but you can sort of have a level of appreciation for it all, isn't it? You know?
You know, I don't think you start out good at it, but awareness of it is the, I think awareness of it is the key. But, you know, there's a thing that floats around Facebook every once in a while, and it's written by a hospice nurse, and it's a list of things that all people that she's been, you know, they've been helping with their end of life stuff, things that they all say. And you read that and it's like a slap in the face, you know. It's like people get to the end of their life and realize, I wish I'd have done more of this, I wish I'd have done more of this. And you read that list and you're like, yes, I could do that right now.
Yeah, it's a funny thing, because one of the other big takeaways and lessons from this whole thing for me has been just realizing that who we think we are is just made up in our mind. Even our memories and everything are of our past and everything are just a collection of thoughts in our mind. And in this current moment, you know, like, it's a bit like with us, we were both born in Australia and everything. We're not in Australia now. We're a long way away from Australia. It doesn't mean we don't have a connection to it in some way, but, like, I've come to realize that, you know, when you go through your life, you kind of, like, I've always had a bit this thing where I grew up in the bush in Australia, in the middle of nowhere a bit, and sometimes I've been in situations here in Europe where you feel like, what the hell am I doing here? Like, if they knew where I came from and what the real story is, they wouldn't have me here, you know?
Imposter syndrome.
Yeah, you know?
Everybody has imposter syndrome, don't worry about that.
Yeah, but also just realizing that's who I was, not who I am now. Got nothing to do with now, you know? And that's sort of... I think that's a freeing thing, because if you've got a bit of a background, I haven't had a bad life at all by any means, but I think, you know, there are a lot of people out there that are struggling with carrying some stuff around, and realizing that you're not who you have been, or you don't have to be that, is just such an empowering sort of way to move forward, you know, like, because where I want to go has nothing to do with where I came from. You know what I mean?
Right. I don't know if you know who Gabor Mate is.
Yes, yeah.
But I read something the other day, and he said trauma is not what happened to you. Trauma is what happens inside you because of what happened to you.
What you hold on to, yeah.
Well, not necessarily what you hold on to, but what's. You don't necessarily consciously want to hold on to it.
No, you don't intentionally hold on to it, but somewhere along the line it's, yeah.
Yeah, it stays in there, and it doesn't necessarily have to be. It doesn't necessarily have to be all that big a deal for it to be trauma. In one of Brené Brown's books, it's really interesting. She's doing a workshop with a group of sexual assault survivors. They're all women, and they're all sexual assault survivors. And the first day, she's talking about trauma, and she talks about all these symptoms, these feelings that she gets in her body and stuff. And then so they start out the next day, and one of the ladies says, "Oh, can I say something? What we normally do in these groups is start out the day by naming our attacker, giving him a name, you know, naming our attacker." And Brené Brown says, "Oh, well, I can't do that because I'm not a victim of sexual assault." And the lady's like, "Yes, you are." Brené says, "No, I'm not." And the lady says, "But you told us yesterday that you have all these, you know, these sensations and things from your trauma." She goes, "Trauma's the same. It doesn't matter what happened to you. It's what it does the same thing to you inside." And she wasn't, and I'm not trying to, and she wasn't trying to lessen sexual assault or anything like that.
But
what she was saying was they thought she'd actually been sexually assaulted because she said, "I have these symptoms of trauma," and they're like, "Yes, it happened to you too." But it doesn't. Yeah. Some people have terrible things like that happen to them, and it doesn't necessarily have to be all that terrible for that. And it affects you the same way. You know,
sure.
It affects you the same way. So, you know, I used to think that I had the perfect childhood and I've got no right to be screwed up. And then you start to learn just little things that happen and how, you know, if they're not resolved, they build up inside you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, 100%. 100%.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We've covered some ground, haven't we?
Haven't we?
I'm supposed to ask you a lot of questions. I better whip them out. Holy cow.
All right.
You've probably already been over some of them. Books. What book do you recommend? We've been over that. Michael Singer, Untethered Soul. Any others?
I mean, I think another one that sort of is complementary to that would be The Power of Now, I think.
Yeah.
I think if I had have just read The Power of Now, I wouldn't have got the depth of understanding as I did from The Untethered Soul. So I The Untethered Soul and then The Power of Now, they complement each other pretty well, I think, yeah.
My son's 24 and I started reading The Power of Now when he was about 2.
Okay.
When you were asking before about my journey, I got about 10 pages into it the first time and maybe 20 into it the second time and, you know, I probably tried to read it about 10 times. I haven't. Well, I don't think I've even read it since changes have happened. I've listened to his other book, The New Earth. I've listened to that a lot on my phone.
I want to listen to that one. I haven't listened to that one.
I've listened to it over and over. Like I'll listen to it and then I'll, you know, I'll be out in the tractor. I'll listen to it again and I'll listen to it again. You know, listening to him, Eckhart Tolle, he's got this very dull German voice. I'm not saying German voices are dull, but he's got this, you know, German accent, and then he's got no emotion. He just talks like this. Yes. And there's some great stories in there. Like, he talks about these two Buddhist monks walking along the road. And it's muddy, and there's this girl comes along, and she wants to cross the road, but she's standing there looking at the mud, like, don't really want to get my dress wet or dirty. And so one of the monks picks her up, carries her across the road, and sits her down. Anyway, they walk on for another 4 or 5 hours, and about 4 or 5 hours later, the monk who didn't pick the girl up, he says to the other one, he goes, "You know, we're not supposed to do things like that. Why did you do that?" And the other monk says, "I put that girl down 5 hours ago. Why can't you?"
Yeah.
Another one is two monks. There's a novice monk and an older monk, and they're sitting down in the forest somewhere, and the younger monk says, "How do I reach enlightenment?" And the older monk says, "Can you hear the sound of that stream in the distance?" And the younger monk kind of listens and goes, "Yes, I can." And the older monk says, "Start there."
Mm.
And the younger monk says, "Well, what if I couldn't hear the stream in the distance?" And the older monk says, "Start there."
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of really cool stories like that in a new earth.
Well, I think the thing that with the untethered soul, what I really like is because I've watched some things of Eckhart Tolle and I've always thought, he says some truths, but for me, I wasn't probably aware enough or didn't know enough to kind of translate what he was saying sometimes. And once I got into the untethered soul, when I listened to what he was talking about, it's like, oh, okay, that's what he means by that. Or that's a bit of a different way of explaining it, but it just helped. But I think he's talking about like being in the present moment. I think he's so good at talking about that, because one thing I've been practicing a bit is like, I've always had a lot of little jobs or duties that I've not wanted to do around the house or here and there. Typical, you know, bloke who just wants to train horses and doesn't want to be bothered with a whole lot of other things. And I used to have a lot of resistance to a lot of those things. And what I realized is that if you don't resist whatever you're doing, you can actually go into a state of like, just peace and meditation almost while you're doing something you don't want to do. The only thing you have to do is decide that you're okay with doing it instead of not okay with doing it. So instead of the thoughts going, oh, I don't want to be doing this, you just let that go and experience the present moment. I've found that if you're not burning up any energy through the day thinking about negative things, you just go through the day like a breeze. But as soon as you start to resist what you're doing, you start to struggle and suffer, and it's such a simple thing, but like what I realize is like I can go through a day now and not every day, but I can work horses all day nonstop and feel like I've hardly done anything, whereas before it felt like I'd just gone through a marathon of work climbing a mountain,
and it's no more physical effort.
It's kind of like the cold
showers and the ice baths. I do. They're the same way. If you reject them, if you don't accept them, oh, bloody hell, it's cold and it's painful.
But
if you accept it and don't judge it, it's not near as bad before. And that's one of the reasons I do them, is because it's. And it's a mental struggle to, you know, you get that, get in, no, I don't want to, come on, get in, nah, can I skip today, nah, that sort of stuff, you know.
Mm. But yeah, well, I think they're great. Like I'm not as hardcore as you, but I just turn the shower on cold for the last bit, and that's, I'm sort of a pretty mild cold water exposure guy.
Oh, well, I was too, and I'm no bloody expert now, but it's, it's a practice that I keep up. I left the freezer plugged in a bit long last night, and I got in this morning, the freezer was about, the water was about 4 degrees Celsius. I had to concentrate this morning to stay in there. That's about 42, I think, Fahrenheit. But yeah, it was a bit colder this morning than I normally do. So I had to focus a bit, and I had to talk myself into it a bit more getting in.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because like I didn't realize before that if you resist things in your mind, it's just like you're resisting something physically. You're burning up your internal energy source or whatever you've got access to, and closing it down almost throughout the day, and then you've got to work on just struggling kind of thing. And I didn't realize that if you let your resistance go to things, that you don't burn up energy, that you have energy, that you're free, that you're clear. That's just been, for me, a huge one, because I'm sure there must be a lot of people out there that are going through the day feeling like they're going up a mountain with a big backpack on when they could be just strolling up there, you know?
Yeah, most certainly. You know, one of these questions that you selected was, if you could spread a message, what would it be? Would you say that would be it right there?
Well, it's got to be one of them for sure. I mean, I think I think probably it's hard to narrow it down to one, of course, but I think there's something about if you can understand the distinction of that, how can I sort of condense this down? That all the sort of peace and joy and happiness that you want in your life doesn't come from achieving anything or getting anything or winning anything or reaching a certain point. It's available to you if you do the internal work, and then that will internally reflect on everything else, kind of thing. And that's not a good way of putting it, but I can't, it's just a way to explain it now. But
that's, you know, I don't know if I've talked to you about it. I've talked about it on the book podcast before, but I read a book a few years ago called Backbone, and it's a men's self-help sort of a book. And it says, at the start of it, it says, most men spend most of their life trying to get four things at the same time, because if I can get all four of those things, I'll be happy. Material wealth, vocational success, health, and love. And that's the big four. That's hard to get. And he said that the ones that do get it, they get there and they kind of go, is this it? And I thought when I got here, I'd feel different. And he says there's three things you really got to have to live a full life. You've got to have a purpose. You've got to know what your purpose is. And that's my next question for you here. You know what your true purpose is. You got to know what your purpose is. You have to have a deep and authentic spiritual belief. And he says that does not necessarily mean religious. Could be mm-hmm. fishing. Mm-hmm. And number three is you've got to get rid of your bullshit.
And so, pretty right.
So anyway, so what's – and I know there's a really good quote of Jim Carrey that floats around the internet. There's a meme and it says something like, he said, I wish everybody could be wealthy and famous so they could know that that's not what it is. But the trouble is, if that's what you think is important, you would have to become wealthy and famous in order for you to figure out that it's not. And who's going to do that? Like, I mean, how many people actually get to be wealthy and famous?
Well, I think in the Untethered Soul, I think he just explains it so well about the fact that your brain decides to let go of the negative thoughts when you reach or the challenges you have along the way. You know, let's just say you have a goal and you reach that goal. The reason why you feel so good is because your brain says, I'm happy with this. I'm going to stop all my complaints about not being where I wanted to be, because I'm where I want to be right now, and I'm going to let you feel good for a bit. And then you feel good for a bit, and then all of a sudden it says, yeah, but what about if maybe I'd like to do this, or I'd get this? And until we get that, I'm not going to be happy. So it really just comes down to, you know, if you let go of the negative thoughts, you can get the same feeling to some extent as reaching your goal and target. And that's the thing for me, you know, like I've come to realize, like, I've had a lot of milestones where I've had those moments where you're like, yeah. But then the next morning you wake up and you're already setting yourself the next mountain to climb. And then as I've gone along, where it got difficult for me is I started to make my mountains bigger, and I started to limit my happiness because the path there was going to be tougher, more challenging, more time, more complicated, more commitment. you know, and then when I get there, I'll be happy. And it's not the way. Yeah,
definitely not. So let's ask this question. What do you feel your true purpose is?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how it'll all play out. But at this point, as for what I feel is that it will be, I have the feeling that helping people and horses is always going to be a big part of it. But where it goes will be interesting to see, because like as I've been doing this sort of internal work, I just realized that, you know, that's where it's at. You know, all the stuff in the daily life is either enhanced or, I don't know, brought down in the absence of that sort of work. And so your internal work, you know, is the answer to everything in a way. And so I don't know how it's going to take place, but I really want to incorporate it in my horse training and teaching. I think it's something along those lines, helping people kind of get to that place a bit, you know.
And I think that's something else we have in common, because that's kind of where I've got to. So I think one of the questions that we haven't covered, I haven't asked all the questions, but you've covered all the things in here. What advice would you give others who are about to enter your occupation?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because one of the dilemmas I have with this is that, and this is the I don't know, it's the tricky part about people learning, I think, is that you don't know what you need until you've banged your head up against the wall enough times. And it's the saddest part, because there are so many people that I've tried to force it down their throat, because I've gone down the wrong path and wasted my time and tried this and tried that. And not saying that I know everything or anything like that, but I've had enough experience to know where certain paths lead you. And I suppose the thing you want to give people coming up or getting into it, the wisdom, so that they can start from a higher point, so they don't have to, you know, go down this exact same path as you have to learn the same lessons. And I think what pairs with that is, if I was saying to someone working with horses, I think you need to find a mentor or trainer or horseman or rider, or someone you work with that you learn and stay with for quite some time, so that you build up. And you have to be careful who you select, because this person is one of your formative people. And if you have to tie a kick around until you find that person, fair enough. But when you do find someone who you know has a great depth of knowledge and experience, spend enough time with them until you have enough of that with you, that then you can go and learn from other people without. What I see the most common thing with horse people is that they have a whole lot of stuff and that doesn't fit together, and I learned this from this guy and that and blah, blah, blah. And they don't have a process. They don't have solid principles. They don't have techniques that lead into other things. And they go around and think that they'll pick all the cherries from all the trees in the world, and in the end they'll have this masterpiece. But in the end, you just have a whole lot of confusion quite often, you know?
Yeah, I've talked about that quite a bit, because people tend to cherry pick the easy stuff. And then, you know, there's a lot of hard work in everybody's program. But what was funny when you started talking about trying to shove this stuff down people's throats because you've made all these mistakes and, you know, you want them to not have to do that. There's another Will Rogers that you're probably aware of. And so if you guys at home listening don't know who the other Will Rogers was, Will Rogers was an American stage and film actor, a vaudeville performer, cowboy humorist, newspaper columnist, and social commentator from Oklahoma. He was born in 1879 and died in 1935. But One of his famous quotes is, there are three kinds of men, the ones that learn by reading, the few who learn by observation, and the rest of them have to pee on the electric fence for themselves.
Oh, there so you go. That's very appropriate.
I think that's what this Will Rogers was trying to say. And that's what the other Will Rogers did say.
That's funny. Yeah. It's what about you in that respect? Like, because you've had a lot more, like you've done a lot more clinics, you've been around a lot, you know. If you're because what I sometimes think about is how do you advise someone coming up? Because, you know, what do you think?
Well, the question, you know, these questions came from Tim Ferriss's Tribe of Mentors book. And the full question is, what advice would you give others who are about to enter your occupation? And then in parentheses, it says, consider, and that can be difficult considering a lot of us have an occupation, the people he's talking to, a lot of an occupation that's not normal. Well, I don't even know what my occupation is anymore because I don't train horses. You know, but if I was if I was going to advise people in training horses, my first advice is exactly what you just said. Find someone who you like you like their outlook on life, and you like their finished horses, and learn their process, start to finish, on several. I mean, even if you're not going to train horses, but learn their process from start to finish. Before you start trying to cherry pick stuff, because what you will find, and then if you can, learn someone else's process too after that. But what you will find is everybody that's good, somewhere in their process earlier on, there'll be some stuff that you do that you think, this is absolute crap. I mean, this is not relative to anything. And it's not till you get to the end of the process to realize why it's 100%, so important.
100%.
And so if you never 100%. Follow someone's process completely, you'll tend to think those little things at the start in that foundation
are just
like, oh, you're being pedantic or whatever, but it's not that. Now, if you do someone's process, you'll figure that out. But if you do, if you go through two people's processes, you'll figure out, oh, yes, it's not just the first guy. It's a fact. Because that's a hard thing. You cannot, you know, that's an electric fence peeing thing. You know, you can't tell someone that those little things in the beginning are the big things in the end. And so once you've done that a bit, then you understand how a process goes together.
Because this is an interesting thing, right? So with a horse, we have the opportunity to facilitate their experience, so to speak. You know, they're working with us, and we're deciding the path and how it works, so to speak. Obviously, the horse is communicating along the way, going through it with us, sort of thing. But with a person, they start out and they go, oh, okay, this is not for me, I'm off. You know what I mean? And so, you know, you don't a lot of the time always get the opportunity. Whereas with a horse, you can help them have the experience that they go, oh, okay. Right, that's what he meant by that. Now I understand the value of that. Whereas with a person, like you say, if you're going somewhere and you're having to do some boring sort of basic stuff, and you're like, let's get to the real stuff. I mean, I'm tired of doing all these sort of little basic things. But like you say, until you've been through till the other end, you just don't know, and that's the hardest thing when you don't know. You think that there's some Disneyland situation somewhere that you miss. You've just got to find it. But the Disneyland happens at the end once you've done all the work and the process, kind of thing. You know?
Well, speaking of Disneyland, this process was highlighted in the movie The Karate Kid. You know, when he thought he was painting the fence and waxing the car, wax on, wax off, you know. And it's all this boring BS. And later on, those are the foundations of his moves he needed to beat the other dude. So,
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so I mean, that would be something I would tell people going to enter this occupation. And the other thing I would do, you've already done it, is tell them to read the Untethered Soul or something like that earlier on, because you touched on it before, that your internal dialogue is part of who you are, and it's a part of how you perceive everything. And this horse does this thing wrong. You can either go, yep, okay, or you can get mad at them.
100%.
And that's 100%. And all that getting mad at them is it's your stuff. It's not. It's a exactly. It's a reflection of you. It's not a reflection exactly. of what they're doing at the time, because you can
100%.
You can interact with that moment completely differently and have a completely different outcome. So it's that's not the horse. Like I said at the very beginning when you said we had all these difficult horses, and I said, were they difficult or were they led to a situation in life where their only way out was to be difficult?
Yes. I mean, for them, they were doing what was working for them, right. but in a conventional sense, it was difficult. But one thing that's interesting about that is if you were to be some young upcoming person and you're in a pretty good place or relatively good place, the thing that I can't help but think is that without the discomfort, without the strong, you know, motivation, some of these things don't seem that important. That's the thing that scares me, and that's where I feel like the biggest blessing of my life recently is being in such a bad place when I came in contact with this book, because it's so easy to read a book. And this is something you know, a guy called Bob Proctor?
Yeah.
You might have heard of him. Yeah. He's quite a famous life coach or something like that. And he tells a story, and I thought this was so true. He said, there are a lot of people in the world who read books. He said, and if you ask them how many books they read and whatever, they'd tell you and they'd be all proud of it and everything. And then you say, how much have you applied from those books? Have you read any single one of those books and applied everything that person told you to apply? and he said, what you'll find is that most people are very knowledgeable, but when it comes to the application, there's very little taking place. And he was told from his mentor when he was young, he got that book, Think and Grow Rich,
Napoleon Hill,
as a gift. Yep. Yeah, and he said to him, I want you to read this book every day for the rest of your life and apply what's in this book for the rest of your life. And that's all I want you to do. And he said, if you do what I say, you'll have all the success you've ever dreamed of. As he's doing this interview, he's 80-something years old, and he's got this old leather book that looks like, you know, it's gone through hell and back, and he says, I still read it every day. And he said, I've been applying this knowledge every day. And there's nothing wrong with learning everything, but one thing I was just thinking about is I'm guilty of reading things and not applying them just as much as anyone else is, but I realize there are some important things that you just should not read unless you're going to apply them, you know? It's sort of a sacrilege to the knowledge almost. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I don't know. That's just something I've thought about.
You know, it's funny that Think and Grow Rich is written by Napoleon Hill. And when I was my late 20s, I think, I had someone give me a set of cassette tapes of Napoleon Hill, and it was the 25 principles of personal success or something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, I had a tape deck in the truck, you know. And I listened to all those things. I listened to them multiple times. Didn't use any of them, but listened to them. But later on in life, much later, when things started going well and getting better and better and better, I looked back and I went, I didn't listen to what he said, but I'm now at this place because what he did was Napoleon Hill grew up in a small coal mining community in West Virginia, and he went to secretarial school, Taft Secretarial College, and he learned how to type. And he went to work for one of the richest guys in the world at the time. He wasn't a Vanderbilt, you know, he either had trains, timber, coal, one of those sorts of things, you know.
Yeah, it was at Dale Carnegie, isn't that right?
It might have been Dale Carnegie, yeah.
It was a Scottish descent guy, yes, I remember. Might have been Dale Carnegie. Yeah,
but anyway,
yeah.
So he what he did was he went to work for him, and over the next 20 years got to meet all the most influential people in the world and spent a bit of time with them and asked them questions. What was the secret to their success? And he wrote down all these things, and he compiled the common denominators. Well, what I figured out was later on when I got somewhat, you know, going things the way I wanted them to go, I looked back and, oh, yes, I did that one. Yes, I did that one. Yes, I did that one. I didn't know I was doing it at the time, so I kind of came about them the same way those guys did. They just how they felt, or what, you know, just instinct or what, I don't know what it was. But yeah, I didn't do it because someone said to do it. I read the book. I mean, I listened to the tapes, and then totally disregarded it. You know, some of it I thought was just crap. Like one of the things he used to do was he'd say, "I always send out my little personal assistant, my mental assistant. If I'm going to go to the store, I tell my assistant to find me a parking spot in the front. And when I get there, there's always one right there."
That's
just the power of positive thinking. That's manifesting. Yes. That's quantum physics. That, you know.
Yes,
and at the time when I listened to that, I thought, this guy's a whack job, you know. And then I realized looking back now that I'd been doing that long before that anyway. I had to manifest a car crash and all that stuff, you know.
Yeah,
it's all very interesting stuff. Well, congratulations, you're the winner. We've now been going for 2 hours and 10 minutes, and I've never been over 2 hours before. So Will Rogers is the longest.
There you go, man.
So far, he's the longest podcast.
Yeah.
That just means you're the most interesting, Will.
There you go. Well, I'll take that. No, it's an honor to be on, man.
Thanks for being on here. So people want to find out more things, Will Rogers. Where do they can't just Google you because they'll come up with the humorist.
Yeah. I mean, Will Rogers Performance Sources on Facebook or Instagram, and Aspire Foundation on Facebook or Instagram. And we have the aspire-foundation.com, the website, if you want to find out more about that.
Okay. We'll put all this stuff in the show notes too. But
Cool.
Awesome. Well, it's been a, you know, as usual, it's been a huge pleasure talking to you. I always enjoy our conversations.
Likewise, mate.
Well, thanks for joining me on the podcast. And for you guys at home listening, thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And we'll catch you on the next episode of the Journey On Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Journey On Podcast with Warwick Schiller. Warwick has over 650 full-length training videos on his online video library at videos.warwickschiller.com. Be sure to follow Warwick on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram to see his latest training advice and insights.